Good morning. Nancy Collins here on behalf of Jeffrey Kinzel. If I could save 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. In this case, the child, NR, alleged that Mr. Kindle committed a charged crime, but her testimony at trial came from her out-of-court statements to a forensic nurse examiner and a child interview specialist, not NR in court. To satisfy the confrontation clause of the Sixth Amendment and of our state constitution, our Supreme Court has said that the prosecutor can't hail a witness to court without asking questions about the event or the hearsay statement at issue. In Clark,
and that's the, which case is that? That's the Price case or the?
Well, the Price says that, but in Price recounts Rorich, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, Rorich and Clark and Grasset, which all have also consistently talked about the same standard and applied to different sets of facts. In Clark, the court said the declarant is a witness at trial, is asked about the event and the hearsay statement, and the defendant has an opportunity for full cross-examination that satisfies the confrontation clause. Here, well, in Rorich, which is most identical to this case, the complainant was brought into court, asked innocuous background questions, but not about the incident. And at the pretrial hearing on child hearsay, NR's testimony was much shorter, but she didn't identify Mr. Kinzel in the courtroom. And she wasn't asked specifically about and didn't discuss the events. And the prosecutor, when the court was...
I understand your position is the prosecutor had to at least say, do you recognize this man that I'm pointing to? Did this man ever touch your private parts?
Essentially that... The prosecutor,
if those questions had been asked, then your case would not be here, isn't that right?
The prosecutor had drawn the witness's attention to those. The prosecutor said at the pretrial hearing on September 10th at page 121, at trial, after I exhaust everything else, if she's not answering any questions, I'll try to lead her, or at least I'll be more direct in questioning. Promising, as opposed to that pretrial hearing where she didn't really say much but wasn't really asked much either, that in front of the jury, he would ask those questions, like Warren indicates she lost in Price as well. But the prosecutor didn't do that in this case. And then when it came to closing argument in this case, the prosecutor conceded that. The prosecutor said on pages 38 and 39 of the closing argument, that NR came to court, she didn't say anything about it, but she didn't say it didn't happen either. She's either forgotten about it or she doesn't want to talk about it, and neither myself nor Mr. Cox, the attorney, pushed her to do so.
What page was that on closing?
That was on pages 38 and 39 of the September 14th transcript.
Okay, thank you.
The prosecutor. But our Supreme Court has said repeatedly in Warwick and Price and Grasso and Clark that not simply bringing a witness to court, that you have to draw the witness's attention to the event and to the hearsay statement to satisfy that confrontation clause. In other cases, for example, in Price, the complainant did identify the defendant in court, talked about the circumstances where the event arose, and then said she didn't remember, initially nodded yes to the question about being touched, but then didn't describe the details of the incident. And that sufficed to draw her attention to the event and to the statement. But here that wasn't done. She was asked, questions like, do you remember seeing a doctor? But in fact, she hadn't actually seen a doctor in these hearsay statements where one was to a forensic nurse examiner and one was to a child interview specialist. So to ask her memory about speaking to her doctor really was neither here nor there. It didn't draw her attention to these statements. The other, really like sort of ambiguous background questions didn't satisfy what our Supreme Court said in Warwick must be satisfied to satisfy our Constitution. Our confrontation clause, that effort needs to be made, that good faith effort of drawing the witness's attention to the incident and to those statements, or they simply don't satisfy the availability requirement of the confrontation clause. If there are no further questions right now, I'll...
So she was treated as an available witness?
Yes.
The general rule under Crawford is... without a prior opportunity to have cross-examined the declarant. Was the was the child hearsay hearing a prior opportunity to have examined the declarant under oath?
Well, the same lack of questioning happened at the child hearsay hearing.
Yeah, but there's no jury, so there's no horror of picking on the victim. There's just the trial judge.
Yeah, in Price, actually the complainant in that case had been more specific, had talked about the incident during the earlier child hearsay, and they used that at trial. In fact, both the defense and prosecutor, Price talks about it in the closing argument, how they used that, the fact that she had talked about it before and not at trial, to discuss, you know, whether it really happened, whether she was credible, that kind of thing. So that would be a different scenario, but in this case, the child hearsay, she wasn't available to satisfy the Sixth Amendment as our Supreme Court has defined it in the child hearsay hearing, pretrial or trial.
Well, the Confrontation Clause wouldn't apply to the child hearsay hearing.
Well,
it would only apply to the trial. It's a trial, right?
Right. Well, in terms of using that,
right? But I'm just trying to. I mean, when was Rorich? Was it before Crawford?
It was before Crawford. It was 1997, and Clark, I think, also was. But you know, Crawford wasn't about the availability component of confrontation. It was about what kind of testimony, whether you can rely on hearsay rules to determine whether someone testimony.
Well, it was about rules that existed to excuse the absence of cross-examination either at the trial or under oath having occurred previously.
Right. No, I mean, I think the Crawford standard is certainly important, but the availability decisions, Green and Owens and the U.S. Supreme Court, are still the operative analysis in terms of defining availability, and of course, as we're bound by our own determinations.
Good morning. May it please the Court. John Jewell for the State of Washington. The Crawford Clause is not violated by admitting out-of-court statements as long as the declarant testifies as a witness and is subject to full cross-examination. Here, the witness, and she testified under oath at trial.
Is it your position that Crawford changed Rorich?
Regardless of whether it changed Rorich.
Does Rorich still control what happened in Judge Kurtz's courtroom?
It doesn't control because that's not what happened. In Rorich, the prosecutor tried to shield.
Does the case still apply with full force in Judge Kurtz's courtroom as it did before Crawford was decided?
I would say yes, if that's what the facts supported that. But the facts don't support that because in Rorich, the prosecutor tried to shield the witness by not asking questions, asked some general questions, and then didn't go into it. It's not what we had here. The prosecutor, he made the preliminary questions, but then he specifically asked if she knew any of her dad's friends. And she answered no. The defendant was a friend who was spending the night at the house, so she would have identified him as a friend. The prosecutor then asked,
Why would she consider him a friend, necessarily? I mean, why not ask the question, do you know this guy here? That's what you wanted to know, right? Did she know him?
Right. She could have asked that, but the prosecutor essentially asked that by saying, are any of your dad's friends present in the courtroom? And the defendant was sitting at counsel table, and she says no.
Well, is that phrased so that's an unambiguous question? He remained friends with the guy that you wanted to prove molested his daughter?
It could have been asked differently, but
Well, it could have been asked, do you recognize this guy who's sitting at counsel table or wherever he was sitting?
They could have asked that, yeah.
Isn't that the question? That is the question. Does she recognize him, and did he molest her?
Mm-hmm. And the prosecutor asking the question, he got no answers. When the questions he asked, could he have pursued it further? He could have. Would he have gotten any other answers? How many no answers do you have to get from a witness before you have established this witness?
Well, if you ask irrelevant questions, you can probably get hundreds of no answers, and you still will not have gotten to the heart of the matter. I mean, the thing is, what this left the defendant in the position of doing, I guess, is proving your case for you or else not being able to cross-examine her because the question was never asked, do you know this man?
Correct.
And more importantly, the question was never asked about the incident. Doesn't the law say that you have to ask about the incident?
And the prosecutor went down that path, too, asked, do you remember talking to the police? She said no. She talked to the police.
Okay, down the path, down the path. But, I mean, you know, the direct question is, did this man touch your private parts? That's a hard question to ask. I understand that. But don't you have to ask it in order to establish on direct examination the critical point, which then counsel can cross-examine about within the scope?
Right, that would have been a better question. Often, though, that question gets an objection because you're now making an accusation, this is the guy, and now he has to deny the accusation. And so the prosecutor tries to ask more open-ended questions, not allowed to ask leading questions, and that's what he was trying to do to get this the witness to acknowledge the event, or whether she remembered the event.
So are you saying it would have been a leading and objectionable question if you'd said, did this man ever touch your private parts?
Without her acknowledging that she knew the man, that he was a man that was at her house, to just point to him and say, is that the man that molested
you? Okay, well, if you had first asked whether she knew him.
And she said no.
Okay, but that question wasn't asked.
Right. She didn't ask, it wasn't asked directly.
Do you recognize this man? Have you ever seen him before?
And again, didn't ask. Would have been maybe better to ask that. But he asked, "Is anybody in the room that one of your dad's friends?" And he said, "No." Again, like I say, trying to get more to what she recalled. Asked, "Did you talk to the police?" She said, "No." Asked about a nurse.
Well,
he didn't know what a nurse was.
You seem to be arguing that she had an absence of memory, when it appears that her answer was literally correct. None of her dad's friends were in the courtroom. The only guy she recognized was a guy that molested her, and he's not her dad's friend anymore. Isn't that a plausible way of viewing what happened here?
That'd be a plausible, yeah, that
well,
she would say no, that he's not the
friend. What did that question accomplish then?
And I would agree that asking a more direct question would have been better. He chose to go to the event, and she gave no answers to that also. I think at that point,
but
he concludes she doesn't recall the incident.
If we uphold this as fine, then that's a way to avoid, in every case like this, to avoid the difficult task of asking the witness, the child witness, about an event that she does not really want to talk about.
No, I wouldn't agree. Once you're showing that the witness does not have a memory of the event, what purpose is it to ask those questions? If she says, I don't remember the event happening, I don't remember it. Well, did this guy do it?
I
don't remember.
How do you know that she would have said, I don't remember it, if you don't ask the question?
The questions that were asked showed she didn't have a memory of the event.
Let me ask you about one thing that she said on page 79 of the direct examination. The prosecutor is going into these questions about, have you ever talked to police? Nope. Mm-mm. Do you know what a doctor is? Yeah. Do you know what a nurse is? No. Have you ever talked to any doctors? Mm-mm. Never? When I get shots for school. Did you have to do that this year? Nope. No shots this year. Uh-uh. Lucky you. And then she says, my sister told them. What do you think she was talking about when she blurted that little tidbit out? The prosecutor doesn't react. The prosecutor says, oh, when was the last time you got shots? Do you know? Now, didn't that indicate my sister told them?
Right.
What are you going to do with that little tidbit of information?
The pretrial motions in limine, they had redacted the statements of both witnesses where there was any comment about them saying what happened to the other.
I
think the prosecutor shied away from that.
Of your claim that, you know, it was the only inference here was that the witness didn't remember anything about anything. What's she talking about? My sister told them. What did her sister tell them?
Okay, let's say she's recalling that her sister talked about an incident. Not about shots, about the incident. She doesn't recall the incident, but she recalls her sister talking about the incident. You know, that's clearly a hearsay that we can't get in, that we can't have
True.
Her tell. What
but
did your
mean,
sister
the
tell
thing
you?
Is you didn't ever ask her whether she remembered the incident. Not you, I understand.
Right, the state.
Well, you say you can't get in, but it got in. That statement didn't draw any objection from the defendant.
They didn't draw any.
My sister told them was for the
right.
jury to consider.
Because we don't know what we don't.
It was uttered under oath, and it wasn't objected to.
And we don't know what her sister told her. May have been about shots. My sister told me she got
Seriously?
Shot.
Seriously? That was responsive. That was a responsive answer to the question about shots.
That was her response. If the prosecutor had gone after it, I think it would have been hearsay that would not have been allowed in and would have been a violation of the motions in limine that she did not talk about what her sister told her.
Doesn't it appear that she has a memory of events and that Mr. Hunter was avoiding to ask her about her memory of those events?
Directly. I mean, she could have said, I don't remember any such incident. I don't remember anything. I don't know this man, and he never touched my private parts. Or I don't remember whether he did or not. But at least right. She would have been asked, and then their cross-examination could have been undertaken, right? You say you don't remember. But
to ask her those questions, we have to get some acknowledgement that there's an event that she has knowledge of. And her answers were she does not recall this event. She has no memory of this event.
Well, you weren't powerless to get an answer. There was a choice made with regard to what questions were asked.
Correct. And when the questions were asked, the answers were no.
You weren't powerless to clarify it, what the extent of her memory was. You wanted to nibble around the corners and then have us draw inferences.
And the case is that when there's a memory loss, the effective cross-examination is to that memory loss. And the defense was given a chance. The defense asked questions. Do you remember Dr. Dan, who was the defense interviewer? She said, no, I don't remember him.
Well why would it, the defendant, I mean, I'm trying to picture cross-examination. You say you don't remember Dr. Dan, and then you go on for another 10 pages about, surely you remember Dr. Dan. And don't you remember a guy that looked like this? But that's all beside the point. It's all collateral. I mean, that we don't really care whether she remembers Dr. Dan or not, do we? I mean, what we really care about is whether she remembers the defendant touching her private parts.
Correct. And she doesn't remember that. And she doesn't remember anything about this incident. As we go around the edges to find out what she remembers, the answer is, I don't remember it. And then the jury gets to evaluate her answers and determine whether is she evading. They're saying, I don't want to talk about it, I'm not going to answer questions, or is she truly a person who doesn't have a memory of this event? And if that is established, that satisfies the confrontation clause. She came, she testified under oath, she was subject to cross-examination, and the jury got to determine her demeanor and whether she's evading or truly doesn't have.
So in other words, when the cases say you have to ask about the incident in question, in your view, you don't really have to ask what the heart of the incident was. You don't have to ask about that. You just have to ask some questions about what you think you know about the sort of surrounding circumstances, where it occurred, who was there, who she talked to about it afterwards. And as long as you ask those kind of peripheral questions about the incident, then you can use that to show that she doesn't have any memory about whether she actually was molested or not.
If that's what the answer shows, she doesn't have a memory, yes. If the answers are showing she does have a memory and you're trying to shield her, then no, that's not effective. But if the witness testifies, again, this was a young child, and the answer is, I don't remember what happened, which is not uncommon for a victim to black out the incident, then you've established she doesn't have a memory about it, and that satisfies the confrontation clause. The state would ask you to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
The prosecutor in this case didn't ask any leading questions, didn't attempt to try to draw out this witness on the necessary information about the actual incident herself or the hearsay statements to the forensic nurse examiner and the child interview specialist, even though the prosecutor had acknowledged during the pretrial hearing that such questions might be needed after other attempts to talk to her about it were exhausted. In Warwick, the prosecutor asked the complainant about what school she went to, what she got for her birthday, what her cat's name was, things like that, but didn't ask about the incident. And that was, our Supreme Court said, violated the confrontation clause because she wasn't truly available. And that same thing happened here. Questions like, did you speak to the police, weren't even actually relevant because the police officers admitted here they don't talk to the kids. They send the children off to the forensic nurse examiner and to the child interview specialist. They say, we ask leading questions, so they tell us not to be the ones to ask questions. So she hadn't actually talked to the police. So the answer that I didn't talk to police doesn't get us here or there, which is why.
And that it was perhaps truthful.
It was truthful that she didn't talk to the police.
And right. Her dad's friends were in the courtroom.
Right.
Both of those things are true, so we should conclude that she has no memory of the circumstances.
Yes, and that second part obviously doesn't follow because she was answering questions. She was tracking those questions. She, you know, there was a question initially. She was, you know, reluctant. Do your parents have a table in their bedroom? She said no. And the prosecutor later in redirect got out a picture of the bedroom and said, yeah, what's that? And, oh, yeah, a table. I mean, you know, if you drew her out on what the incident, the prosecutor could have certainly done comply with the requirements of Warwick and Price and Clark and satisfy the confrontation clause, but that wasn't attempted in this case. And for that reason, we ask you to reverse the count involving NR. Thank you.
Okay.